all that mining for old movies and old reasons stuff. G.I. Joe.
Tell me more about the Shogun.
I finally stopped playing with the Shogun when I lost the
like 6 months ago.
Yeah, it was shooting.
They were really tall. You know how the first G.I. Joes were really big?
Yeah, I mean, when I was like.
Is that where that comes? Because you're like, they were like, you're putting your hand up and they're like 4 feet tall. It's always
the Shoguns were.
The Shoguns were. They were. You could tackle these things.
But the G.I. Joe originally were very big, then they became action figure small. And then all of a sudden, Shoguns came. Yep. And that was when, I don't know, I was 10 or 8 or 10 or something like that. And they were this tall.
They were big.
2.5 feet tall, I would guess.
Nice.
Really big. So, like, immovably big. They always had to be the bad guy, basically, because you had all your other little action figures.
Because they were tiny, they would fight the giant overwhelming odds.
They couldn't move. Their legs didn't do much. They moved back and forth, and they were on wheels to move.
And they were on wheels.
But they had shooting things, like, you know, like a later fist, with like Micronauts and all that stuff, you could put your eye out. They didn't shoot anymore, but these things did. They shot
with fish. Kids would choke on.
And they shot hard. Like, it was weaponry.
Do you remember when toys used to hurt?
That was it. That's the point.
I think we used to carry them around like in a baby sleigh, you know? And we put the little Shoguns here, and then we just run around shooting them at each other. Nice. So you'd run.
My brother, a couple years back, put some serious effort into tracking down an original set of lawn darts.
Jarts? Yeah, they're called jarts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, they had metal tips.
Yeah, that would stab kids.
And they're like a hula hoop that you had to try and get them into. Yeah, jarts.
And you loft them up.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're here on the Reflex Blue Show.
Lovely.
We've already been going. That's all gold. I am down with Shogun talk, and now I'm going to look this up when we leave. I'm Nate Voss. I'm your host today. Donovan Beery is out. In for him today, Steve Ridiculous Gordon. How you doing today, Steve?
I'm good. I'm glad that you had me over. Having some fun, chatting up some of the childhood toys and whatnot.
We're doing all right. We are on quite a fixed schedule due to many circumstances beyond our control. It is a rainy fall day here in Omaha, and we have Dave Behringer here with us from North Carolina.
Wait,
did I do it right?
Behringer,
all that effort, and then as soon as
I just remember because Behringer. I would be Steve Gordon Hargy.
You'd be Steve Jordan.
See, if I had
that's
a soft
a different,
G.
Actually, but that's your comic character.
See?
So, Steve
if I had a soft G. He is
so Dave Behringer.
Soft G.
That's Dave, right. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Sorry about all that mess.
That's fine.
Dave is the author of There's Nothing Funny About Design and many other books. I have my notes here. That's he is an author, freelance writer, designer, photographer, and artist. You may have read his work in periodicals such as Voice, ID Magazine, I, Immigre. We got Looking Closer 5, Speak Up. There's a fantastic interview with you that's up on Design Observer that I totally read in preparation for today.
I personally like the Bug Funeral.
The Bug Funeral Kit. Let's start with that.
Those are awesome.
I'm going to talk about the book in a second, but tell everybody listening about the Bug Funeral Kit.
The Bug Funeral Kit was a tin box.
Yep.
And inside the tin box is a variety of things, all so that you could host is it mainly for kids, so that they could host a funeral for their dead bug.
It's legit, too.
Yeah, you can really do it. So it's the Spanish moss kind of as the thank you, Michaels, art supply store, in the bottom. And then it has a book of eulogies for your dead bugs written as if the child was eulogizing the
dead bug.
I saw,
like beetle, butterfly were examples
on
there.
Goodness.
Stick bug, things like that. And then it has a little casket. Coffin kind of thing you could put your bug in if you desired. And then a scroll that I actually have to roll up and tie with a white ribbon. Burial scroll that gives you instructions for what to do. A flower, the headstone, and then seeds of grass. So that if you filled the tin box with soil, you could bury your bug in it, put the grass seed on it, grow the grass, and put your little grave marker on that.
You could grow your own buggy little garden.
I love it.
I'm hoping to expand to horses.
You're leapfrogging me.
The kit is just not big enough.
Yeah, who can find a tin shed that big?
Well, everybody who buys it.
You go down to Lowe's. I need a shed.
Costco.
It's for my dead horse.
Looking for a tin shed and some dirt. Maybe some seeds. What?
Everybody who buys the kit says, you know, this was funny, this was great, my kids loved it. And a lot of people are into bugs. I mean, strangely enough. They actually do use it, and a lot of it is boyfriend girlfriend buying it for each other because, you know, somebody said they love butterflies, and so their favorite butterfly or whatever it is they buy.
It's a cool
praying mantis, things like that. But then the next thing they say, especially with kids, is you got to do one for pets, you know, for fish, dogs, cats.
Because I was going to bring
up little mice.
Fish.
Well, yeah, there's no ceremony for it. Like when the pet dies, the parent just stammers for a while. You
and then
know,
there's
like,
the toilet.
toilet or grandma's farm up north. Or, you know.
Can I say there's a brick under my deck in my backyard for my old, for Stephanie's old
is
fish
there really?
Right now.
See,
we had a little thing. We don't even have kids, but we were like, I respect you, fish.
Well, see,
sending
I'm
you
even
out right.
A, I'm even a little more sinister just because I'm not a buggy guy.
Okay.
I don't like bugs. But I would get the bug funeral kit as like a, some kind of sarcophagus, you know. I'll keep you in there like Han Solo, bug.
Oh, God.
It's just, it's kind of like, you know, it's a gun you don't have to fire to enjoy. You just, you know, any the bug is there, you just show them
exactly.
The kit, and then they go away.
Exactly.
This is going to happen to you today. Yeah. If you don't move out.
That's awesome.
So Dave, tell us a little bit about There's Nothing Funny About Design. Now, this you are much more an author than you are a designer
right.
by the research that has been available to me. So and you've written novels, you've
right.
written nonfiction. What brought you to writing about design and what is this book all about?
Two big questions. I'll go fast with the what brought me to design. I think what brought me to start writing about design was the job I had. I was working kind of part-time for a creative company in Detroit, and we did a lot of work for the auto company, and I started out writing for them for an automotive magazine. And so I was just the writer. I would travel and write every article. And we're a smaller place, so we would always get busy. Everybody was doing other projects in my little magazine.
I kind of want to jump in there. Do you like roll out and like test drive cars and do any of that kind of fun
stuff? I did.
Stuff,
I didn't get to drive the car, but went out on test tracks, which is a lot of fun. We went on.
Seems
a test
like that
track.
Would be a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, we got off on the right foot.
The test
Dave,
track is.
I'm upset.
The test tracks are really they're built almost so that the guy can actually take his hands off the wheel, and the way it's curved is the car just drives
it's
itself.
It's just gonna hug it.
Yeah,
there's all different
force.
Yeah, it's great. So we were in a minivan, like we had like four to six people, and the minivan is just flying on the test track, zipping around. He's not even holding the wheel.
See, I'm so glad I asked that question because
awesome
I just love
question.
That.
It
awesome
was
question.
Really scary fun. And then there's all different parts to the test tracks. There's the one where you go fast, and then they a lot of it is consumer testing. Like they write from the point of view of the consumer driving
it.
Does it rattle? Does it shake? Does it do
right.
all these things? And so they have test drivers do that. There are other parts of the course where it goes over gravel or goes through water or goes downhill, uphill, back around. So they put it through like
a chicanery.
Like a boot, boot camp obstacle course
for
cars.
Yeah.
And then they write down how the car performs and all these under stress.
I picture in my head that's like evasive maneuver training for security drivers.
Yeah, there's a part at the end where it's just like the scene from Blues Brothers where then they just drop it off the bridge.
It's more like Ninja
how does
Warrior.
It take that?
There you go.
Yeah. Ninja Warrior for cars.
Can you get your family?
Can you scale this wall vertically? Okay, so sorry. Interrupted. You were saying about how you got into writing about design.
Yeah, it was kind of practical urgency. So it was, we had to get the magazine done, and we were always doing late nights, all-nighters to get the magazine designed. And eventually they started pushing more off on me to get it done. So I started sketching the magazine out on pieces of paper and saying, how about this photo there and that photo there. And I didn't know it was called art directing, but that's what I was doing is
nice.
I was laying it out by scribbling my nasty little scribbles, and then it would improve the speed. And then eventually they just said, this is silly, you know, here's your computer, here's PageMaker or whatever, here's PageMaker, and here's how you, you know, input images and go away. So then I would start doing it on my own, and then it grew from there. So I had no training whatsoever, barely even knew how to use the software.
There's a part of me that wants to just diverge again now and just talk about PageMaker back in the day.
Yeah.
I used that in high school newspaper, and we would just take, like, I don't know, mess with, what's that one? Tracking, leading, just shrink it. We'd have overlapping type just because we could.
Completely.
I switched, of course, now I'm in design. I have not gotten even the creative suite. I'm still stuck in ID2. And I had to go back.
Hey, word up, right here.
ID2 is legit. ID2 is legit.
It's free. That's
I'm on CS2, but no.
CS2, I'm ID2.
You're in design 2, but I have a that was my InDesign.
My wheelchair is not motorized.
I skipped
but
the
you're
CS2.
Strong.
I'm strong. Yeah, big forearms. Yeah.
Okay, so you've started art direction.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, Yeah, they did that, and then they threw the software at me, and then it went from there. And then I really just did everything for the magazine. So and in order to do that, I had to teach myself how to do it. So I started buying graphic design magazines and subscribing to the magazines. Or I'm sorry, to buying books, subscribing to magazines, and stealing ideas. That's really what
yes.
I had to do.
All right,
love that.
And it really, the funny thing about stealing ideas is that whatever it looked like in the beginning, it looks nothing like it when you get it done.
How many
so
times
I don't even know how
it's doing the victory here.
You can't even call it stealing because it looks either better or different. I mean, you have different photos, you have different text, you don't have the same font, so it really almost doesn't matter. I was almost stealing the grid that they did. Like, they put the photo here and that there, and so I did that and changed the color. But I needed that. I didn't know what the heck I was doing.
That's so interesting. I love that you said that because... in the talks that I've given and the times that I've that subject has come up, designers are notoriously, all of us, are notoriously protective in hedging our ideas. But I've often said, take out your pencils. If there's 50 people in a room, 50 straight lines, they're all going to be different because they went through the process of you doing it. Even if you were taking the idea, borrowing, whatever, it comes out like you did it, and that's cool.
Pardon me, I was going to say that, let me give him that. I was going to say that I feel like it's stealing when it's worse. And you were saying, like, it's going to be different, it's going to be better. When it's worse, it's stealing. When it's better, it's an homage. And when it's different, it's just, hey, maybe that idea came from anywhere. I'm not sure.
Well,
inspiration is what it is.
Right.
I was dealing with, you know, magazine layout. I mean, that's all I was taking was the layout. Because you got to do a different story layout. Every story layout was different.
Yeah.
So from issue to issue, from page to page, you turn the page, I have to do it differently. So it was just like, oh, I can put the title here. That'll work. And I'll put the photo up here.
Yeah.
So it was really those sorts of geometric spacing.
Which is
things
still pretty challenging.
And nobody's going to look at it and say, that looks a lot like the Obama photo I took. You know,
that's a Nate Voss layout there.
right. No way. So that's how I got into design and to discovering the world that people wrote about it and thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't decide to actually write about it whatsoever until I had read Emigre. And I read Emigre issue 66, 65, 66. Not the first one, not the rant one. I didn't actually ever read that one.
Right.
It was the one that came after that. And I had never heard of them. And so I had bought that and read it, and suddenly I started writing. So that was where it started.
Awesome.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the book, There's Nothing Funny About Design.
That was most of the graphic design or the design writing I'd done after I wrote the Emigre book. So I wrote a book for Emigre as the first thing I'd ever written on graphic design.
Was that the word
the American Mutt?
Oh, American Mutt.
No,
okay.
We Were Ugly is the fiction book.
Okay.
But the American Mutt book was about graphic design, autobiography about graphic design. And that opened doors for me to write for other magazines. I had been a freelance magazine writer previously. I'd written for Details and places like that. So it was the magazine world wasn't new, but graphic design was. And so I had gotten some introductions to ID and even print, but I've never written for print. And a few other places. And so I started writing small articles, and they asked me to write a few things. And so it's a collection of the things I've done for the last 5 years.
It's interesting. As a designer who writes, I would be interested in hearing how you got to doing some freelance writing also, because I do quite a bit of writing, and that's an interesting avenue that some creatives do. I know Nate does it.
Well, I do it on blogs.
But I think...
If you were going to ask me, I'd say you pull a Steve Gordon, you show up at Howe, hug Bruno the whole lot. Maybe she'll send you a writing job.
But I mean, it's an interesting line to cross that it runs pretty parallel, because in a lot of the things we design for, there's writing, there's text. Some of those things might overlap, and designers find themselves, you know, scrawling a bit to put some words to their visuals, or even writing for our own stuff, for blogs, for websites and whatnot. Where was that crossover for actually writing freelance for other periodicals? Was it you got discovered? Was it you sending in treatments?
The first, I wanted to be a writer, but didn't know how to get paid doing it. So I actually went to law school. But before I went to law school, I decided I would try to write for magazines. And I was 22. So I wrote a query letter to Details magazine. And the only reason I got a response was because the editor who read it was from Michigan, and he and I was from his hometown. So he said, nice. I'll give this hometown kid a chance.
Yeah, everybody and needs
they,
a name.
Now, they always need new blood because they write about the same thing, sex, fashion, and, you know, movie celebrities over and over and over again. So every magazine needs somebody new to write about it in that generation's way.
Right.
So, you know, they're looking for young people who can put a sentence together. So it's partly that, and then partly that I got lucky that he decided to respond to me. And then it wasn't like it was easy after that. They were doing a lot of personal essays at that time. And, you know, I wrote about buying and owning a gun. I wrote about massage, like erotic massage. And I wrote about
good
white
subject.
Clothes.
Yes. Good like, subject.
I feel like Steve, you can massage. Tackle
good
that.
Subject.
Guns, massage, white clothes, double-breasted suits, you know.
That's a range.
That,
right
leads,
there.
That, that leads right up to design, naturally.
But that's...
erotic massage.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
But there was,
and
you know,
gunplay.
At my first job. Actually, we did get massages at my first. It just was not erotic at all. Sadly, it wasn't that kind of design for him.
So, all right. So you end up querying, pitching story ideas, you know, a dozen at a time, and they pick one because of the season, and they need something on double-breasted clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I pitched a lot of stuff. And once you're in, you can get connections to other magazines. But you have to move sort of fast. And in fact, it happened with design recently, since the people at a lot of the design magazines have left or moved.
Right.
And so you're a writer in the editor's stable only as long as that editor is there. Once that editor moves, you start all over again.
Yeah, like sports. The coach brings his team in.
Yeah, yeah, and he brings his assistants and all that. Let's do a sports metaphor. I'm game. I don't know.
Love it.
Yeah, no. Steve, you tell me the way it is.
Dude, we've had erotic massage and gunplay. We had to get sports
let's
in
get
there.
Some sports in there.
And complete.
And man show. All right.
Show.
Like this cliched metaphor, and then he throws you a curveball.
Actually, I don't think you need a show. You just need the opening credits to keep playing. You know, you just need images and
that.
Glimpses.
There you
and
go. You know, kimonos and, you know,
the oil,
hair
like,
sticks and
like
oil.
Like Dexter, only with oil and skin, you know, no blood,
and
just
then,
oil.
And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, the guy is the masseuse.
And every ending is happy. And there you go.
And that's the motto of the design firm, not the masseuse.
You have a design
ridiculous
firm called
design,
happy endings.
Every, ending is happy.
Every client
that's
goes
really
away
funny.
Happy.
That's really funny.
If ridiculous doesn't pan out for you, you're solid.
Oh, that's it.
I'm telling Donovan to make that the secret track.
Seriously, dude. 10 years from now, if that show pops up, Soft G here is going to be upset with me.
Hey, you got, don't you have like the producer of Chuck is Mick G? Weren't we just talking
about
that?
It's true,
like,
he is Mick G.
I'll be Soft G.
I'll be Hard G.
We almost talked about Chuck in the ride over here. This first season, season one, first like 3-4 episodes of Chuck.
Yeah.
Mad good.
Yeah, it was legit.
It became a sitcom. I still love it.
It was legit.
With everything I got. I went to Subway and filled out comment cards.
Right.
But those first like 4 or 5 episodes of Chuck.
Legitness.
Way different.
Legitness.
Speaking of Chuck, except not at all. So you've got the book. I wanted to ask you about.
Oh yeah, I wrote a book.
You've written some books.
I forgot about.
We've
that.
Been talking about the writing.
We were developing TV shows there for a while.
That's
what
we do.
I wish I could have got all that.
I'm stuck on gunplay.
I don't. I'm solid. I love this. Okay. Right. Dave, I wanted to ask you. You said in an interview with Ellen Lupton, you said, "I think what designers need today are business partners who know best how to value the designer's work in the marketplace." Mm. So that when you know what do designers need the most right now, I would was wondering if you would care to expand on that, or at the very least, what is it that you see that a lot of designers are missing where it would fill that void?
I actually think it's broader even than designers, but I can go back more specifically to designers. But in general, I mean, I've run across it with professionals who are, lawyers and doctors. They end up going to school for that field, that discipline.
Lawyer,
it really
doctoring,
isn't,
yes.
Yeah, there's no business component. But anymore today, they get a job out there, and it really is a lot of business they have to know. Those partnership models don't really exist like they used to. Suddenly, they are expected to know a great deal about things that they never took even a class. They didn't go to business school to learn about insurance and partnership models and how to build equity and all that kind of stuff and how to negotiate with the managing partner as the firm is going out of business. I mean, it's just, it's a totally different world.
It's massive, right.
The thing about, so that there's a practical reason that some of those models are just going away, and you really need to know how to take care of yourself as a business person or an entrepreneur or something like that. Then there's the other side of it, which is probably more psychological, which is creative people, I think, tend to devalue what they do. Especially with a computer, it seems so easy and fast, even though it took you 4 years of school or whatever it is that takes you to get there, and thousands of dollars to buy the equipment and the machine, still you could do a poster or a logo or a brochure in an hour or two. And mm-hmm. so you think, you know, how much is that really? Yeah. You know, just an hour, $50 here, yeah. whatever. And so you end
up
with these...
We are a self-loathing bunch from a financial standpoint.
I feel that.
There's all this thing in your head, well, if I do this, it'll pay off later. I'll get that, and and it seems easy. And I think this is true because you just devalue what you do. So you need somebody else to smack you on the head and say, "You do this, and
you
let
need
me
a
take
hype man.
You take. Yeah. I'll take care of the rest: the business part of it, the expenses,
awesome.
The accounting, the pricing. How do you value your own work? That's kind of what I meant. You need a business cheerleader and somebody to make those decisions about value and the business part of it, because you just don't. You didn't go to school for it. You don't know about it. It's just a fact.
That's an interesting... I took an interesting tangent right when I heard the quote when Nate read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, even from the standpoint of not so much clients but business partners. Like, your client... You also need a client who understands the value of what you do.
Mm.
And in that sense, they would be your business partners also. You know, it's not like go to the grocery store, search down the list, and find the cheapest alternative and take it. No, someone who values paying the price, paying that premium.
Well, and
that your work
certainly exists, but that's what iStock's trying to do is their
mm.
model now is
right.
go to the grocery store or buy a logo,
right.
that kind of thing.
Right.
But
making us a commodity versus an actual service.
Right. And so that's the difference between, you know, their, and I'm not sure entirely how I come out on that, but that's probably going to take care of most of those clients that don't really understand or care about what
right.
we do, but
right.
and certainly hopefully leaving the others back around. But
right.
but I mean, I was like, man, definitely that the entire line of thought of, oh, well, if I do this now for less, oh, it's going to come back, it's going to pay off. I have burned myself on that very thought far more times than I care to admit.
Oh, even currently it happens where you're like, okay, I'll throw this in because it'll come back around, won't it?
true story. And this happened not all that long ago, where I had been sending out bids for jobs, and sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't.
Right.
But then I had gone back and seen bids that I had sent out a year ago, and I had found that, and I feel safe, I'm not aware that any of my clients actually listen to the show, and I have so few right now anyway, it probably doesn't matter. But I had found that the ones that I had been sending out had steadily been, like, as the work had becoming a little bit more sparse or a little bit less frequent, I had found that my estimates had started going down a little bit more. Like, I was edging myself out, hedging my bets. Oh, I might not get it. Maybe if I charge just a little bit less,
right.
then I'll get that job.
Right.
And, so I stopped doing that, and since then things have been better again. But
you need to create a shell company. Create a shell company that underbids, and then you come in at the
nice.
Other bid, and then either way you get the job.
Or I don't need an underbidding
do a
shell
company that underbids and does horrible work, and then you
yes.
save the day.
And either, both of them are you.
And you can constantly talk bad about the guy, like, that guy does horrible work, let me help you out.
Open up blogs are free. Open up a new blog, a new Gmail account, and there's your company. You're done.
Nice.
If Donovan were here, he would say, why would I need a shell company if I got Nate out there?
He would totally burn you with that.
I'm just like, man, I'm so glad. I'm going to throw that at Donovan. That one was for
you.
You
just gave him a free
yeah.
zing, and he's
I'm
not
giving
here.
Him a free one for that. But
you zinged yourself on his behalf?
That's
friend.
The way we roll.
That is a solid friend.
Wow. Yeah. I'll give him those.
Yeah, my buddy would punch me in the nuts right now, so I'll do it.
Yeah.
Go home and give yourself a wet
blanket. Yeah. So Dave, we keep tangentially.
Dude, that sounds
that
like
hurts.
Yeah, that does sound painful.
Hey, wait.
And I'm sorry that we did that to Soft G.
Tangentially.
I'm sorry that we went all tangential on Soft G.
Well, thank you.
Win a date with Trisha Tangential.
Trisha Tangential.
Come on.
When you make it a woman. Oh.
Does that happen after the massage? I got a I have a
It's always after the massage.
I got tangential after going to the erotic massage, and I think it had something to do with the gunplay.
I love that. Like, I can't wait because this is all gonna cut. Donovan's gonna cut this show. He's gonna be like,
why were you talking about tangential?
Yeah, and
it was out in the sun too long.
And what is the massage parlor? Where did that?
That's so classic. We've nearly been speaking about your book.
Oh man,
we keep nearly touching on it, tangentially touching on it. It's a word. Actually, it's a thing now. That's going up on Urban Dictionary.
New album, tangential.
Including the track Touching You.
Touching You.
My God. I'm so struck.
This is awesome.
Change the paper, you're next.
Cut, print, check the gate.
Before we're rapidly running out of time for both the show and your time frame this evening. I have not read There's Nothing Funny About Design. Sell me on it. So it's writing that you've done. It's previous writing that has been collected, as I understand it.
Yes and no. It's old and new.
Okay.
The great thing about it is I was able to, when you're a designer and a writer, you get to do it all. So I was able to do it all except for the cover, which I had somebody else do. Felix Sockwell did the cover.
A little fancy line art, thrown a lot of like old Milton or Picasso style on it.
Actually, I like Sockwell.
Yeah.
Very good stuff.
So we had, and I was designing a cover for it and just was miserably cranking out dozens of covers, you know, for your own stuff. It's never good enough because you know too much about the book, I think. I was trying to do a perfect cover, which doesn't exist, so I gave up and had him do it. Thank God I did that. The rest of the interior I did do. In fact, I had done it originally. I did the whole book, sent it to the publisher, and then when they said yes, then I spent a lot of time after that rearranging the book. It went from 300 to 250 to 300, back to 250. It was really expanding and contracting, adding the images, and really working on the typesetting and what we were going to include. And then I wrote quite a bit of new stuff in it. So it's a collection of design writing, new and old, and even the old stuff is edited and expanded. You know, a lot of the stuff that had to get cut for the magazines, I was able to go back and expand a little bit, add some new stuff and more images. And then there's tons of 50-page new section that's almost like graphic literature kind of stuff. So a fiction, nonfiction, philosophy, fun thing to read in there.
Well, and I've heard, you know, one of the comments that everyone that seems, or at least the quotes that are out there, seem to think the book is great. Also quite biting, a little bit cutting on the graphic design, maybe shedding a light on things that we don't quite, or we care not to look at so much.
It could be. It's hard to say. The criticism part of it means you think about it and you interpret and you think about why stuff is. So I'm not, there isn't a part of the book where I start taking apart some studio or some, you know, West Coast, East Coast style of design.
Gunplay comes back in.
Yeah, there it goes. it really is taking an idea, an icon, a symbol, or something that's out there and following a thread of it through. The skull, the letter X, the evolution symbol, the ape to man graphic.
Yep.
Those are the essays that I've done before. In fact, I've written new ones on, you know, the motorhome graphics. Why are they that way?
Saw that, yep.
That's awesome.
The top hat. I ended up researching the top hat, and it goes from, you know, the founding of the country with Indians and the British all the way up to today. I mean, you can really have the history of America following this top hat. It was really fun. So those are the sorts of things I sort of obsess over. And then the other stuff are personal essays about what it's like to work as a designer and have a family. Then there's satire in there about self-help and personal power. Some of the stuff I had done for a magazine, I repurposed and fixed up and made look better in this section called Live Well Now. And then the final section is the business of design, and that was the almost literary fiction humor kind of stuff as if it were a business of design guidebook.
Wow, that's cool.
And I try to do a few things that I'd not seen before, so this is not the same old essays about Paul.
Yeah,
Land
and that's
and, you know, that
kind exactly. Of stuff. I mean, and to be perfectly frank, how many more of those can anyone really read? But no, that sounds like there's just a wealth of different kinds of content, and that sounds really interesting. I'm gonna check it. We do book reviews on the site. I'm sitting on one right now.
They do.
We did one for this guy.
They did. Yeah. Speaking of Felix Sockwell, I love the cover for the book. Instantly got me intrigued. The illustrations in my book were kind of an homage to
his little bit, style. single line mm-hmm. illustrations. So. Yep. My God, we're making connections here.
You'll have to talk to Felix. He is now having his own book, I think, come out. I might write an introduction for it.
Selling logos on Logo Lounge, that kind of thing.
It is, if I can preempt the, I don't know what his press is, but I think it's called Logo Sexual.
Let's do it. You heard it here
preempt
first.
I love it. Felix's book, Logo Sexual.
God, yeah. Design is dirty.
It's a great idea. I can't believe
nobody
said that.
Dude, design is wicked dirty. Like, Steve, your next book, just design is dirty.
Design
I like
is
it.
Pitch dirty.
It.
Seriously.
Dirty.
Maids, massages, gunplay.
Gunplay. Thank you for gunplay.
And Asian women, but not massaging.
And gigantic mechanical robots.
Also.
Thank God he didn't say 10 genitalia.
No! Alright!
I wanted to leave that for Soft G to say.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much for being
Absolutely.
On the show. This is a blast.
Thank
Steve, thanks for coming
Not
in,
a problem.
Man.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everyone out there, for listening to the Reflex Blue Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more coming at you. Late.
Peace.
To send questions or comments to The Reflex Blue Show, please visit 36point.com. The Reflex Blue Show is hosted by Nate Voss and Donovan Beery, music produced by Dust Lab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.